Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in the headlines today with the travel ban, we are lucky to have with us now a sitting judge from a sister court, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, Judge Harvey Wilkinson. The Ninth Circuit, where the action is right now, is in San Francisco. The Fourth Circuit is in Richmond. Judge Wilkinson comes to us today because of his new book, and we'll also ask him about the news of the day. The book is called All Falling Faiths, Reflections on the Promise and Failures of the 1960s. Judge Wilkinson, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
It's a pleasure.
So by way of a little history first, you describe how at Yale, you were in the class of 67, and you had some notable classmates, including George W. Bush and John Kerry. And you write about how you and Kerry came up with a clever plan to share the presidency of the student government. Can you tell our listeners that story?
Well, yeah, he was ahead of the Liberal Party, and I was ahead of the Conservative Party. And so we John and I talked about a coalition deal, and the conservatives, which I headed, were going to get behind John for the presidency of the political union. And then the next year, John was going to return the favor. And I said to him, John, you know, I'm taking you on faith about this because I'm going to deliver the Conservative Party support first. And he said, no, I'll come through. I'll come through. And he did. And despite differences, he remained true to his word. And I've always appreciated that. I'd visit John's room, and he had an awful lot of pictures of the Kennedys there. And his initials, JFK, were, of course, the president's. And it's okay, but he didn't let folks forget that.
JFK and JFK. And so just what was an example of a student issue at Yale, a student government issue that broke down along left-right lines, that it became a liberal-conservative thing?
Well, I think the real issues were civil rights and the Vietnam War during those years. And the Vietnam War started off being a liberal and conservative issue. But as time went on, the interesting thing was that I think large numbers of conservatives began more and more to see that this war was exacting simply a terrible toll, and there were 58,000 casualties at the end of it all. So something that started off as a big left-right divide, as the 60s went on and the call for ever greater numbers of troops increased, and there were no or few results to show for it, it became, I think, an issue where the campus was united, but for some reason the Johnson administration and the powers that be in the establishment in Congress were very slow to pick up.
And we know that war rolled on all the way to 1975. You also write in the book from that same time period that as a student at Yale, George W. Bush mocked the whole decade of the 1960s. And that was while it was going on. How did he do that?
Well, he was very casual about it all. And in retrospect, it seems to me delightfully casual about it all. A lot of us were just strung tight and wound tight and deep into this political debate and that political debe. We sort of wore a grim countenance to our face. But George Bush, he was just pretty casual during all of those years, and I pitched football with him, and he enjoyed that. And he was a big hit at his fraternity, and he was a person that everybody could come to and have a relaxed conversation with. He's very popular.
I guess not the one who would have been voted most likely to become president of the United States.
People trick you, though. I mean, some of the most successful people that I know might have been voted the least likely to succeed.
My guest is Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Harvey Wilkinson. His new book is All Falling Faiths, Reflections on the Promise and Failures of the 1960s. We can take some phone calls for Judge Wilkinson on current stuff or what he writes about in the book that we're discussing at the beginning of this segment, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And before we get all polarized between people who, you know, respect the 1960s more and people who respect the 1960s less, I did notice that you wrote near the end of the book, "When I've tried to despise the 60s, I've never quite been able to." Ha. Huh. So why don't you despise the 60s, and then why did you write a whole book critiquing them?
Because there's no the issue is not totally simple. And I try to point out that the 1960s did some real good, but I think that the overall damage was terrible. But my hope is that this polarizing period that we all lived through, and we did so much to divide society in our youth, and I'm hopeful now, nearer the end of our lives, that we can devote some time and effort to healing this country that we did so much in the 1960s to drive apart.
A lot of the book is dedicated to descriptions of different institutions, I guess you'd call them, that collapsed under the weight of the 60s. Your chapters are things like the decline of education, the destruction of commitment, the demise of law, the loss of home, the fall of faith. And I guess, as a big picture thought, maybe on the other side of that, I would tend to think that institutions fail largely because they don't work for enough people anymore. So if liberals in the 60s rejected old institutions of organized religion the way it was, or marriage and gender relations the way they were, maybe it was because they were becoming dysfunctional for too many people. Same with Trump voters today or Bernie Sanders voters today. If the two political parties are being seen as the parties of the elite, if the media are seen as out of touch, maybe we are. Maybe one of the strengths of a democracy is that we hold institutions to account in real time. What do you think about that?
I think it's an entirely fair point. The problem is that in a reaction to institutions, we just went too far the other way. For some reason, the pendulum never stopped in the middle during and after the 1960s. One can take the sexual revolution of the 1960s as an example. I mean, it's maybe Victorian thought and Puritan thought had made the 1950s all too repressive, but the 1960s went too far in the other direction and in helping to with in making personal relationships more fleeting and more ephemeral. It worked in inestimable net damage on our family structures, to the point now where the more disadvantaged folks in our society don't have the opportunity that a family can give them. And marriage, to an extent, is becoming more and more an upper-class estate. So my view is, yes, you make a valid point that a lot of those institutions were hidebound and were due for some correction. But my point is that the 1960s, in their zeal to correct them, went way too far.
You want to take an example? I could throw one out or you could pick one. I noticed that you wrote that one of the reasons that government got so big is that there was a big rejection of the private sector that was maybe unique to American history.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I think was difficult for me to understand, because my father and the folks I knew had been associated with banks and law firms and insurance companies, and in many cases they were milkmen or construction diggers or bricklayers, masons, or whatever. And then I got to Yale, and for some reason, the private sector was looked upon as a second-class sector, and what was praised and everything was government. And in my history courses, for instance, the heads of corporations and the heads of private institutions were sort of demeaned as unfeeling and not doing any particular good. And, of course, there was a validity to some of that criticism. There's a balance that has to be struck here. But I thought the private sector was held in disrepute during the 1960s, and that it was and that government was looked upon as the one true opportunity and one true career. So the private sector really took a hit, much more so than I think it deserved.
Maybe where you stand depends on where you sit, or is that cliche the other way around? That for you, growing up in Richmond, going to an all-boys Christian prep school, son of a bank CEO, as you say, the world looks a lot different than to, a lot of other kinds of Americans, without going down a list, who might have experienced the 1960s and where they have led us to today.
Gosh, that's such a good point. And one of the things I try to recognize is that I was lucky. And I'm going to be true to who I am. I had a very privileged background. And so all I can say is that I think a memoir, which I've written, in a very personal story, is more persuasive if the memoir's voice is an honest one. And rather than try to hide who I am or what I am, I say, look, I admit I grew up in privileged circumstances, and others grew up in circumstances that were very different and less advantaged of my own. But can we look at it this way, that everybody's experience is sort of unique to themselves? Nobody's experience can really cover all of this diverse and pluralistic country that we have. And the way I think we make it work is that we share experiences. And one of the things I'm trying to point out is that the 1960s were damaging to many people whom we needed most to afford opportunity to. But I'm not trying to hide anything. I grew up in very lucky circumstances. I'm fortunate. And I'll be honest about that at the beginning. I'll be honest about that in this book at the end. And I hope that this is something that our conception of the damages that the 1960s inflicted is something that we can share. And I'm not shouting at anybody. I'm asking the reader to take me by the hand, go through those years. I try to see the 60s not just through my eyes, but through all sorts of different forms of eyes in the characters I try to bring to life in my recollections, in my memoirs. But The point you make, what can I say? It's entirely valid.
My guest is Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Harvey Wilkinson. His new book is All Falling Faiths, Reflections on the Promise and Failures of the 1960s. And we're going to take some phone calls for you. People are calling on things you've been saying here in your reflections and things in the news right now. And we'll start with Richard in Hollis, Queens, who says he's a lawyer. Lawyer meet judge, judge meet lawyer. Hello, Richard.
Hi. Judge, it's a pleasure to listen to you And in spite of the fact that you say how lucky you were, you have a great sensitivity about things around you which go beyond your luck and which give us an insight into how you were raised and by whom you were raised. But, Judge, my question is this. Can an appellate court, say a federal appellate court, take judicial notice of statements made outside of the record by people who are relevant to the record on the issues being determined by the court? Shall I give you an example of the current situation?
You're talking about what Giuliani said regarding Trump asking him to craft a Muslim ban that falls on the right side of the law?
And what President Trump said during the campaign in connection with what he was going to do with Muslims.
Thank you very much. Judge, you know that all our listeners want to know what you think about that.
Well, I think that it gets very dangerous when judges go outside the record of the case and try to take into account someone's campaign's statements or the others. I mean, the one thing in this very tumultuous time that we need to do is judges have to remain impartial. We have to be one place where the American public has confidence that we're not partisan and we're not partial and we're not taking an oath to the President of the United States or to anybody else. We're taking an oath to support the law and to support the Constitution.
So he's asking if that can be a piece of evidence that would have meaning. It came up in the oral arguments last night.
Well, I'm not sure that a campaign statement ought to be that much of a piece of evidence. I mean, I'm not familiar with the particular case, but I think it would be a very dangerous thing for judges to go too far outside the record and take note of things that don't actually meet the rules of evidence that allow something to come in.
Even though the lawyer for Washington State argued that intent should be a meaningful aspect of the judge figuring out whether it's a religious test, intent.
Yes, but there again, I'm not I think it would be very dangerous for me to try to preempt the Ninth Circuit because I wasn't there at the oral argument, and I don't want to weigh in on the arguments that were made before them. They are the ones that have heard the arguments, not me. And what you have to realize is that everybody who's offering an argument, the other side has another argument and has an argument in exactly the opposite direction. But I'm really reluctant to jump in and to say how the Ninth Circuit judges should resolve the case.
Thank you very much for answering that question that thoroughly. And Josh in Midtown, you're on WNYC with Judge Wilkinson. Hi, Josh.
Hey, how are you? Good to be here. So here's my question. You know, Donald Trump tweets and he says something like the so-called judge, or he says if there's an attack, this judge is responsible. So, as a human being, obviously you're a judge, and can that not affect you? How do you deal with that? Do you ignore it? Is it possible to ignore it?
That's a really good question because I've been on the receiving end of an awful lot of criticisms for decisions I've made and opinions that I've handed down, and I don't respond. I think that I've had my say, and the people who don't like the opinion, they're going to have their say. And I think that a judge, in trying to respond, loses a sense of judicial dignity that it's essential that we maintain. I just feel like as you start to respond, then you just become another political actor, and you just get in the middle of another mud fight. And there are enough of those going on without the judiciary jumping in. So no matter what is said to me and there that said about me, and sometimes people have leveled some pretty hard accusations and criticisms of what I've done. But that's their right in our country. That's their First Amendment right. And I bite my tongue. Mm-hmm. I will not engage in a tit for tat because it would lower the esteem of the courts.
Let me present you a follow-up question to that from an esteemed special guest. We had the Slate legal affairs writer Dahlia Lithwick on the show last hour on the Ninth Circuit Court case. And I mentioned to her that you would be coming on the show today, too. And she told me that she is a huge fan of yours. And so I asked her, well, what's a good question that I should ask Judge Wilkinson that I might not have thought of? You're a legal affairs expert, and here's what she gave me.
Well, I first want to say that I am one of Judge Wilkinson's biggest fans. He and I both live in Charlottesville, Virginia, and so you're not going to get me to help you cheat. But I do think probably a very, very abstract question along the lines of, what does it mean if the president is making comments about the integrity of the judiciary? How does a judge put that aside? Because it seems to me that Judge Wilkinson has written so frequently about judicial independence and the need for a judicial branch that really does act co-equally as a check, then it might be a useful thing to just ask a very, very abstract question about how you put the Twitter feed aside when you're deciding a question that really has to do with checking executive power. I wish you luck, Brian. He's a much smarter guy than I am.
And actually, it turns out that Dahlia was asking the exact same question as the caller we just heard. So let me put up a point on Dahlia's question and follow it up in a slightly different way. Do you feel that these are just comments that the president is making that are part of the normal political discourse? I know he's not the first president ever to criticize a judge. Or is the institution of judicial independence somehow threatened by the early actions of this president, or it seems like he might go, as some commentators have been positing?
Well, first of all, I want to say how fond I am of Dahlia and how terrific she is. And I've told many, many people I'm a Ronald Reagan appointee, and I said, one of my weaknesses is I just can't help but like liberals. And Dahlia comes from the liberal side of the spectrum, but she's perfectly wonderful, and it's a nice thing in America if we can really form these personal ties that get us talking to one another, as Dahlia and I do. As far as the comments that are made on Twitter and the rest, we in the judiciary have to rely on our friends to stand up for us. We compromise ourselves if we get in a back and forth of this kind of nature. But what you hope is that people in the legal profession and Americans all across the board hold dear in their hearts the values of judicial independence and the rule of law. But for them, it's so much more effective if they are the ones, the defenders of the judicial process are the ones that do it. If the judges start getting into it and do it, we'll only compromise ourselves. So when we're under fire, mm-hmm. we have to rely on Americans who understand what we're about.
So you're glad they're out there right now.
I sure am.
Judge Harvey Wilkinson from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond. His new book is called All Falling Faiths, Reflections on the Promise and Failures of the 1960s. We so appreciate your time and your openness. Judge, thank you so much.
It's all my pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.